From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. What do you do when it seems like you've lost everything? For seven men in North Carolina, that was the question after the loss of their wives to cancer. They came together in grief and found solace, solidarity, and hope. This hour on Point, seven widowers reimagine life. You can join us on air or online. Is this your story? What helped you through your grief? What didn't? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio are the co-authors of the group Seven Widowed Fathers Reimagine Life. They co-led the Single Fathers Due to Cancer program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Donald Rosenstein is a professor of psychiatry and medicine and director of the Comprehensive Cancer Support Program. Don, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks so much. It's wonderful to be here.
And also in the studio, Dr. Justin Yap, professor of psychiatry. Justin, welcome to you.
Thank you, Jane. It's a real treat to be here today.
What an amazing book. I have to say that right out of the gate. Almost couldn't put it down. What motivated your work with widowed fathers? Don?
Thanks for asking. So this work came directly from our clinical experience at Lineberger. Essentially, we have a weekly clinical conference where we talk about new cases, difficult cases, challenging cases in a case conference. And one week, Justin came in and talked about the tragic early death of a woman with young children at home. And in looking around for support for this gentleman who was really struggling after his wife died, we realized that there really wasn't anything out there. And so that led to a series of conversations with other fathers we knew and the beginning of the group.
Mm. So, Justin, this didn't start as a research project. There was a real clinical need out there.
Absolutely right. We did not go looking for this project. It really found us.
Mm. So seven men in your group. Tell us about these men. They were all in mourning the deaths of their wives.
Yeah. So these seven men, really incredible men. Each of them had lost their wife. All but one lost their wife to cancer. One lost his wife rather suddenly. And by the time that they all joined the group, they were all somewhere between, I think, 4 to 9 months out from losing their wives. Each of the seven fathers had at least two children, and a couple of them had four.
Mm. And did they want to speak with only other men in the group? Is that why this was an all men?
Yeah, I think that none of them wanted to speak with anyone about anything, quite frankly. They were just trying to get through the days at the beginning. And we had an initial meeting with two of the fathers just to ask them whether they thought this was a good idea and might have legs. And so there was reluctance at the beginning, I think. And, you know, a couple of these men had been to bereavement groups, but there was no existing group like this. So I don't think they were looking for this at all.
Right. So they weren't necessarily willing participants.
No, not really. In the first support group meeting that we had, it started off rather. It was tough. It was awkward. None of the men really wanted to be there. I think most of them probably came for their children. And one of the fathers, Joe, mentioned that he was not really a support group kind of guy, and that got a lot of heads nodding around the table. And I think maybe relieved a little bit of pressure that first night.
So they may not have wanted to come that first time, but boy, what started as a 6-week trial lasted 4 years. It turned out to be a lifeline for these widowers. What made it so successful?
I think the men connecting with each other was the special ingredient here, and that's something that anyone who's ever been involved with a group that comes together is hard to describe, but it's quite powerful. And so, increasingly, Justin and I took a bit of a back seat and let the men problem solve together and find their own way. It was an interesting moment when there were some of the first disagreements within the group, but essentially they bonded very strongly and quite early and in a way that just carried them forward in a fantastic partnership.
Give us an example of a disagreement.
Sure. So one of them came early. One of the fathers, Neil, mentioned in a conversation during one of the group meetings that he felt like the wrong parent died. And that was a sentiment I think felt by probably all the men at some point. But another one of the guys, Carl, challenged him on that and said he acknowledged that he had had similar thoughts, but that he found that really wasn't a helpful or an adaptive way to look at it. What their kids really needed was two parents, and that wasn't possible anymore. So it wasn't that the wrong parent died that was the problem. It was that a parent died that was the problem, and Neil was not persuaded that night. And actually, as we mentioned in the book, toward the end, there's a little bit of a coda there where Neil came around on that some, and I don't think he ever felt like he could in any way replace what his wife Deanna had meant to their family, but that sense of the wrong parent dying had been assuaged, and that began with Carl challenging him on it that one evening. Mm.
It was such a moving chapter in your book. It's called "The Wrong Parent Died." That's the name of the chapter.
Yeah.
When these men thought it should have been me, if my wife had been here, life would be so much better, especially for the children, right? And that led to a conversation about being a good enough father.
Yeah. So this was an idea that I first learned in my psychiatric residency training. It was a concept introduced by a psychoanalyst, a British psychoanalyst named Donald Winnicott, called the good enough mother. And the basic idea is that perfect parenting is neither possible nor desirable, and that what kids need is a connected, present, loving parent. But there's a certain amount of optimal frustration in any parenting relationship. And so I think what happened was these guys initially felt so much pressure to be both dad and mom and get it all right that they felt there's just simply no way to be successful in this regard. And when I first introduced that notion, and Justin and I talked about it one night, again, lots of heads nodding. It's like, that's really helpful.
Talk about grief for a moment, because these men were all intensely suffering, right? Did you see a pattern among the men in their grieving process?
Well, I think that they would all say that there was a period of at least several months where they felt like they were in a fog. And things just didn't make sense, and they couldn't, you know, tell up from down and forward from backward.
Especially with little kids at home.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, for all these gentlemen, on day one after the wife died, they were dealing with trying to figure out their own grief, helping their children grieve, manage a home on their own, and all the other challenges they had. And these seven men, like I think probably most people, don't really know much about grief and what these men kind of thought they knew. Their passing, you know, sense of kind of what they believed they knew about grief was probably outdated and not really helpful. And that's one of the things that we were able to, that we actually learned ourselves in doing this group, and were able to hopefully help these men do that too, is kind of a more contemporary way of looking at grief than what has been understood for decades now.
Well, so speak more about that, the dynamic in the group as it related to this emotion of grief. How did that dynamic change over time, Don?
So Justin and I came to think of these men as experiencing something that we called grief plus. It's just, as you just heard from Justin, that it wasn't just a matter of losing their wives. It was a matter of trying to do all these other things. And I think, as you just heard, there was this sense of that the men had that they were supposed to progress through an orderly set of stages of grief. And it's really much more dynamic than that, that what we heard from several of the men was, you know, I should be past this by now,
right,
but, you know, I still keep going back to this. And that's when we discovered and shared with the men this this fantastic model called the dual process model of bereavement, which was kind of described by two psychologists in the Netherlands. And it just describes a much more dynamic, oscillating kind of, you have to do things to try to go forward, and you, at the same time, you have to kind of look back periodically, and you go back and forth between those. And that really help them understand that it's not like a certain amount of time can go by and then they should be done with a certain stage.
Let me bring one of the men from your group into our conversation. Joining me now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is Bruce Hamm. He joined the support group for widowed fathers in 2010 after losing his wife, Lisa, to colon cancer. He's the father of three. He is also the author of Laughter, Tears, and Braids, A Father's Journey Through Losing His Wife to Cancer. Bruce, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Thanks for having me today.
Well, I so appreciate you joining us to share your story. What compelled you to join this group, Don and Justin's group?
I think I was just desperate. I didn't particularly want to go to a group and bare my soul, but I was hurting so bad, and my kids were hurting so badly that I was just looking and grasping for anything that might be able to help us.
Did you think of yourself as a support group kind of guy before you showed?
Absolutely not. Yeah. I went to one group, and there were a lot of older people there and folks who'd lost different family members, and it just didn't work for me.
So what was that first meeting like?
That was grueling. We each went around the room and shared the story of losing our wives and talked a little bit about how helpless we felt and how inadequate we felt as parents. And we went one at a time. I think there were eight guys in the room that night. And it was just grueling. It was very, very painful. But in a way, it was cathartic to get those emotions out.
Was there one common theme that brought you together, that bonded this group?
I think a sense of being overwhelmed. I think a lot of people, folks lose family members all the time, and it's incredibly painful. But I think when you stack on top of that, the parenting aspects with elementary or middle school age kids or a combination of both, we were all overwhelmed at the level of responsibility on top of the grief and on top of working full-time and trying to provide for the family. So there were so many components that we were getting lost in that we were just absolutely overwhelmed.
You use the word desperate and overwhelmed so far in your descriptions. Did that change? Did that evolve over time as you worked out your emotions with this group?
No, sometimes I still feel overwhelmed. But I do believe that we got a little more comfortable handling the day-to-day details of the family, which was important, and a little more comfortable with our grief, too.
We are discussing grief and how to reinvent your life after unspeakable loss this hour. You can join the conversation, how did you adapt to life after loss? The death of a spouse, a parent, a friend, is it still too difficult to talk about? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing how to put one foot in front of the other and walk a new path after devastating loss this hour. You can join the conversation. What challenges did you face as a single parent after the death of a spouse? Has a support group helped you process a death? Where did you find community and comfort? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Don Rosenstein and Justin Yap, co-authors of the new book, The Group, Seven Widowed Fathers Reimagine Life. And also with me from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is Bruce Hamm. He joined the support group for widowed fathers in 2010 after losing his wife, Lisa, to colon cancer. Don and Justin, what do you hear in Bruce? You were with him for so many years, but looking back now and hearing him presently, what are your thoughts?
I guess what I feel and what I hear is someone I've come to really admire and respect so much, that this has been a partnership with these men from the very beginning. They helped us think about this work. Justin and I were clearly not experts in this area because I don't think anyone was when we started. And they've been part and parcel of us thinking through this difficult terrain, helping us review papers that we've written. They encouraged us to write this book. They've helped us, you know, put together a research survey. And so, as I listen to Bruce, I think this is a guy who has done the work, and I'm just so grateful, but both to him and the rest of the guys in the group for being part of this experiment.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Hamm, you are the father of three girls. I'm curious if you'd share with us the big parenting pitfalls and the successes, really, in the first weeks and months and years after your wife's death. What stuck with you?
Well, I think I made a lot of mistakes. And the great thing about the group was we would go in and kind of compare some of the stupid things that we'd done. And it was almost like old men sitting around talking about the olden days and how they walked to school barefooted uphill in the snow. And each of us could come up with something worse or something stupider that we had done, which made us feel like, man, I'm not that bad at this parenting thing. And so it was very comforting to know that I wasn't the only one that was making mistakes. Mm. That there were others that were doing things just as stupid as I was, and that our kids seemed to be taking it with a grain of salt and moving forward in a fairly positive way.
The book recounts the story of you, Bruce, of your daughter, really. She came home from school one day with a new pair of shoes. Tell me that story, Bruce, would you?
Yeah, she came home one day and said, "Dad, I got new tennis shoes." And I said, "Well, honey, where did you get them?" And she said, "Well, you know, the bottom of my shoe was falling off." And I showed my teacher on the playground. And she said, "Honey, don't worry about it." And at lunch, the teacher went and bought her a new pair of tennis shoes and brought those shoes to her. And she said, "Dad, they're just as good as my old ones, but the bottom's not coming off." And I said, "Well, honey, why didn't you tell me that your shoe was falling apart?" And she said, "I did. You just didn't hear me." And I was so overwhelmed that I didn't hear her say, "My shoe's falling apart." And I felt horrible that my kid was running around the playground with the sole of her shoe flapping off. But I grew to accept that there were others around that could help me through this situation and just accept that help.
You had a teenage daughter as well, and that brought special challenges.
Absolutely. The day that we unearned her mother, she started her period, and she was 12 years old. And for me, that was my oldest daughter. I had never dealt with anything like that before. And she kind of took care of it. And I went in the room and said, "Are you all right?" And she said, "Yeah, Dad, I'm okay." And we kind of left it at that. And through the years, we've sort of laughed about some of the things that I just didn't know how to handle.
We have so many calls here. I want to get a few in. Randy first in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Randy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. I'm not sure why I called other than I guess my wife passed away last July.
I'm so sorry.
I can't tell you how much I wish I had a group like this here. It's so hard to figure out all the things that need to be done. I've got three kids in middle school. The oldest is a girl, and they're fantastic kids. And it's just really hard to know what they need and what they don't need, and to be there for them properly. Because at the same time that I lost, basically, you lose half yourself. My wife and I have been together 15 years. And it really feels like you're off balance all the time. I just want to make that comment. Thanks very much for the show. It's great.
Randy, thank you.
I
appreciate it, and good luck to you and your family. Randy, thank you.
So, Randy, Don and I really appreciate that you called in and that you shared that. And I would want for you to know that what you just voiced is exactly the kind of thing that we heard from Bruce and all of the men, especially earlier in their grief. And if you're less than a year out from your wife dying, you are early in your grief. And, you know, you hear Bruce today and he sounds great and he is great. But he'd be the first to tell you he had many days where he sounded just like you just sounded now. And he may still have some of those days. And Randy, we don't know you, but I imagine that you're doing right by your three children. And we really appreciate you calling in.
Bruce Hamm, what would you say to Randy there in Florida?
Man, I understand exactly how he feels. It's a feeling of being overwhelmed, of feeling like you're not capable and providing your kids what they need. And I remember, you know, getting home from work and trying to be there for my kids and then going till 12:31 in the morning, day after day after day, trying to set up play dates and fill out registration forms. And just figure out how to log in to the school website so I could make sure they weren't failing school. But it does get easier in time. And what I've found is that my kids were really forgiving and incredibly resilient. So as I worked to be this perfect parent, I realized that that was probably more important to me than it was to them. Mm. They just wanted a dad there, somebody who loved them that they could count on. And when I screwed up and sent them with tuna instead of toiletries that they were supposed to take to help other families. And, you know, my oldest daughter told my middle daughter, get used to it because this is going to continue to happen and it's just not that big of a deal.
Don, in the book, you talk about this in the context of these of the dads in the support group saying that they were worried that their parental incompetence would only compound or even magnify their children's trauma. So from a counseling perspective, how did you address that?
Yeah, I think that forgiveness is an important word in this regard. And I think that, parenthood in general is a humbling process, I think, for anyone. If you're not feeling humbled, you haven't been paying attention. And it's even tougher when you're going it alone for whatever reason. But what I would say is that the two things to remember are, number one, that you need to be present, connected, and kind of compassionate with your kids. And number two is you're not doing them any favors by relaxing some of the expectations. I think a lot of times kids would not want to go to school in the few days or weeks or months afterwards and then do their chores or whatever. And I think structure and the usual expectations and some degree of discipline is really important because their worlds have fallen apart. And part of the task is to kind of life does go on and those expectations should be held.
Randy, thank you for the call. Let's get another in here. Jake in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. Hi, Jake. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. My heart goes out to Randy. I lost my wife in 2009 with a long, ugly battle with mental illness that left me with a 13-year-old son and an 8-year-old daughter. She just graduated high school and was on her way to college, and I couldn't be more proud. There were some rough moments, but we got through it because I didn't know what else to do except give all I had to them. I was raised by my mother, so I knew a little bit about single parenting.
But Jake, thank
recently,
you.
Within the last year or so, my uncle, who was a long time married to the love of his life, she was accidentally killed in a home. He had a gun, and it went off, and it was 1,000,001, and she died. And I'm trying my best, like hell, to make a connection with him. And what I think would bring us together, I don't know. It feels like he's almost pushing me away. I don't know if it's because he's older. They never had kids, but
it's a struggle. No, Jake, I hear you. Thank you very much. A lot of calls, a lot of comments on our website like this. I want to read this one from a listener who says, my best friend died at 35, leaving behind a husband and a 5-year-old child. Her husband has never recovered, and I don't think he ever will. He started dating within 2 months of her death, and all the relationships were doomed to failure. It wasn't that they weren't nice people. It was just too soon, and he hadn't done any real grieving or introspection before diving back in. I think he was just trying to replace the mother. But you can't do that. We aren't interchangeable. After the last relationship ended, he began drinking heavily and has become a self-imposed recluse. Their child was brought up by various girlfriends and my friend's family and close friends who took her often on visits and trips. She's a wonderful young woman and has been very successful in her career and goals. She reminds me very much of her mother, smart, strong-willed, and driven. I just wish they could both be success stories. They're not always happy endings.
They're not always happy endings. But most of the time, things get better. Not always. One of the researchers that Justin and I discovered in doing this work was a psychologist at Columbia University.
George Bonanno. Yeah.
George Bonanno, who wrote an interesting book called
the other side of sadness.
Yeah. And he's done a great amount of research showing that, in fact, most people do well after a major loss, but some don't. And there's a small but measurable group of people who struggle mightily. And we talk about that some in the book and kind of how you can tell the difference between what is "quote unquote normal grief," and when it becomes something more, and it's important to kind of keep an eye out for that, especially when there's substance abuse or other kinds of mental health problems.
Let's get John in here from Jamestown, Rhode Island. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. Jane, what I say may help Randy, and the word resilience in children is an important word, I think. My brother, when his wife was 35 and they had 7 children, she passed away from melanoma cancer. And it was an insurmountable burden for my brother. He had to work and try to raise 7 children. And we all pitched in to help. But it was the kids, really, that did the most psychological work, I would say. They had the qualities of their mother, that is, generosity and energy, and my brother ended up being a grandfather. He never remarried with grandchildren who he loved, and I credit the kids, and I credit the wife's character. So even though it may not be a success for all the men involved who lose their wives, the children can be an enormous success in overcoming adversity.
John, thank you very much. What a wonderful call and full of hope. Bruce Hamm, you heard our caller there. I mean, you've talked about your pain as gut-wrenching, as bone-chilling, deep and perpetual with very few moments of light. For those who are experiencing tragedy or difficulty, what would you say about finding hope in the midst of all that?
You know, for me, I went to a counselor early on, and I feel like that is critically important, is to get grief counseling one-on-one and or in a group. And she told me that it would be 3 to 5 years before I felt normal again. And I said, that is unacceptable. And it did take 3 to 5 years, probably 3 years, to feel really, really good again all the time. And sometimes grief still bites me. But I think you just have to want to get better. For me, I didn't want to live in sadness, and I did not want my kids to live in the middle of a house that was full of grief all the time. We talked about Lisa, we cried and shared our experiences, but that wasn't the place that we wanted to stay. So I made my mind up that we would not do that, and I think that was very helpful.
Your book, Don and Justin, is marked up, dog-eared on many pages. One particular part that I thought was so moving was the section where one of the dads recounts how his wife started to prepare him for her passing just before she died. She gave him instructions, and these are the instructions. Don't let the boys fall into the wrong crowd. Check in with their school counselor twice a year. Listen patiently when one of them has a rough day at school. Make sure they get good grades. Make sure they go to college. And then she says, remarry and find happiness again. And then she says, if not for yourself, then do it for the boys.
Absolutely. And that was a real gift that she gave to, I believe the father was Russ in that situation, that she gave to her husband. Because part of the challenge that Bruce and Randy and the other fathers we've heard from today are is having to reimagine your life and to move forward. And that's that natural resiliency that can kick in that you heard some of the fathers talk about, and you hear Bruce talking about kind of making a decision to move forward. And certainly for some of these fathers, conversations that they had had with their wives prior to the wives' deaths went a long way. And that's actually something that Don and I are working on, a kind of a second part of our project, is really learning from bereaved men about their experiences leading up to their wives' death, and now learning from bereaved mothers learning about their experiences with their spouses leading up to their death.
So what does it mean to reimagine life after something like this?
So this is something that kind of emerged in our conversations over time. And I think the best way to describe it is that all of us have a fantasy about what our life is going to look like, how it's going to unfold, an imagined future trajectory. Growing old with a spouse, seeing your kids graduate from high school, get married, have kids, whatever it is. And the fact of the matter is life doesn't always cooperate in that regard. And so there are lots of small, medium, and large adjustments that you have to make. These men have had to make dramatic adjustments. And so I think part of the problem is how you think about a new future for yourself when the old one you had is taken away.
We're opening up a conversation about grief this hour and healing for widowed parents through the book. It's called The Group, Seven Widowed Fathers Reimagine Life, and you can join the conversation. How do you commemorate the life of your parent or spouse? What advice do you have for families processing their grief? Much more after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I just...
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing mourning and moving forward after the death of a spouse or a parent. You can join the conversation. Where did you find hope after the loss of a loved one? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Don Rosenstein and Justin Yap, co-authors of The Group, Seven Widowed Fathers Reimagine Life. And Bruce Hamm is a member of the Single Fathers Group. His wife died of cancer. Let's go back to the phones. Vanita is calling from Huntsville, Alabama. Hi, Vanita.
Hello, Jane.
Hello. Go ahead.
I am different from the cases that have been calling and that you've been talking to in this hour.
Okay.
I'm an older woman, and I lost my husband of 44 years suddenly to cancer 3 years ago. And the comment I want to make is that... I went to a counseling, a personal counseling for a couple of times. Mm-hmm. It didn't help. And I joined a group, and I found that it didn't really help me. And what I realized on my own and through reading and et cetera was that grief does not follow the pattern that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross once upon a time talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Though I commend her for starting hospice, etc. I think that what she said about the stages of grief and so on, it simply did not work for me.
Mm.
But a comment made by one of your speakers did speak to me, and because it relates to my situation. And it was that I found that grief oscillates, goes back and forth, recursive. You go back
mm-hmm.
and you come out of it. And on my own, I figured out, or through resilience and training, perhaps in Vipassana meditation, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
but perhaps all of them,
mm-hmm.
that we are enormously resilient. And I'm an old woman who lives alone, and
yeah.
The death happened unexpectedly, so I had to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just called upon my own, or I didn't even call upon it. I just waited, and as one of your callers or writers said,
mm-hmm.
you have to be present and connected and compassionate.
And there it was. Vanita, thank you. Thank you so much. I do appreciate your call, but that's an interesting point.
Yeah, so I love that call from Vanita, because we wrote this group certainly about widowed fathers and in partnership with these seven men. But we also wrote it to speak to larger issues of grief and healing and adaptation, and what helped these seven men heal and reimagine their own life has applicable lessons for anyone, Vanita or anyone else having to reimagine their loss after a death, or losing a job, or having your home foreclosed on.
What are those broader implications.
Yeah. So one of them, I think, has to do with meaning making. That one of the common experiences for the men in this group and hundreds of men who we've studied in our research since the start of this group is a sense of loss of meaning. That, you know, the worldview that you had is shaken to the core. And so after an experience like this, it's a gut check. People have to stop and ask themselves, what is most important to me and how I live my life and how can I find meaning going forward?
And Justin, so this experience has informed your work with end-of-life care more broadly speaking, right?
Absolutely. Don and I both work with patients at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital at the Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. And we frequently work with people at the end of life and often with parents with young children, parents with terminal illnesses, and having this experience, hearing from bereaved parents, you know, after the passing has completely transformed and informed how we interact with patients, young parents facing terminal illness. And speaking for myself as a clinician, I'm able to, you know, have the insights and understanding to the degree I can of what these parents are going through, precisely because of the seven men in this book, the hundreds of men who filled out the surveys on our website, and everything that we have learned from people who have talked with us after the loss of their wife.
So what can we learn from those who are bereaved?
So this work started out of our work in a cancer hospital, and most of the deaths that we talk about were related to cancer. But there are so many questions that we don't know the answers to. We always get questions about what about widowed mothers, which is terribly important, every bit as important as widowed fathers. We just started with the men because that's how the work unfolded. But now we are studying widowed mothers and widowed fathers who have lost a co-parent, not just to cancer, but from other illnesses or accidents, or even as suggested by an earlier call, or mental illness. And so we're trying to understand differences about cause of death and gender differences and timing and the age of the kids. And so what we hope is that people who have experienced this will help us learn. We have a website called widowedparent.org, and on that website are resources for widowed parents, but also a detailed survey that is fueling some of our research. And we'd like to learn from people so that we can inform how we better care for parents at the end of life. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to mention one other thing that hasn't come up yet, and that is that these are the stories of the seven men. They're not our stories. And so Justin and I are donating any proceeds from this book back to the Widowed Parent Program at UNC Leinberger, just so that we can continue the work and learn more.
Let's get Curran in here from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Curran. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, gentlemen. I am a widowed mom of two boys. My husband passed away from melanoma 5 months ago today, actually. And I wanted to call for two reasons. One is just to give a huge thank you to the authors of the book and the men in the group who shared their stories. I came across it because of a local support group at the Children's Room in Arlington, Mass., which is just a terrific resource for people who, families who've lost a parent or lost a child. Our group there seems very similar in spirit to the one described in the book. And as a widowed mom, I found the book so, you know, 99.9% relatable to what I'm going through as well, losing the co-parent and just trying to face the day-to-day and figure out a whole new plan. So
our best to you, Curran. Thank you very much for calling. Don.
Thanks so much for that call. One of the things I'd like to mention is that we, in our time here in Boston, have partnered with a local Boston area organization called Empower Her, which is a terrific not-for-profit group that is dedicated to mentoring and special events for girls who have lost their moms. And we haven't talked much about the kids, but it's critically important. Our early motivation for doing this work was as much to help the children by helping their dads. And so there's a lot more work to be done because I think that this population hasn't been studied and served as well as it should be.
Bruce Hamm, jump back in here. After your wife passed a few years ago, you joined this support group with the seven men. I'm curious, do you keep in touch with them?
Yeah, we get together generally once a quarter or maybe a little less than that, but we get back together to kind of catch up and figure out what's going on with one another. And Justin, and we got one dad, Carl, who will just say it's time to get together, it's time to reconnect. So we have continued to try to keep up.
It wasn't just a support group. You've said it, that group became a forum for reinvention. How so?
Well, I think we developed significant friendships, but I think the other thing is that we really encouraged each other and held each other accountable and pushed each other to get well again. And it is incredibly helpful when there's a little bit of accountability to your grieving and healing process, and that's what it was for us.
This is a hard question to ask, Justin and Don, but does idealizing a spouse who has passed get in the way of moving forward?
I believe in certain situations that yes, it absolutely can, and there's a tendency to canonize those who have passed, and that's not specific to widowed parents by any means. I think where it can prove to be a challenge is when the time comes, if the time comes, that the person wants to start dating again or forming new relationships, and we've heard more than once that it's very difficult for the fathers to manage kind of honoring the memory of their wife while still exploring new relationships. And you know, it's not, you know, for Bruce, for example, he and Lisa did not choose to leave each other. Now Bruce is he's I think handled it beautifully, but I would imagine that he and the other fathers would say that's been a challenge, or at least something that has to be communicated with the person that they may start dating or forming an intimate relationship with.
Let me get Ray in here from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Jane. My mother tragically passed away about 3 months ago, and I was with her when she did pass. And I live in another state. I live in Kentucky, and my father lives in Virginia. And I'm grieving myself, but I know that he's grieving even more than me. And I was wanting to ask, what suggestions do you guys have to help me help my father? He sometimes doesn't even want to take phone calls from the children, my brothers and sisters, and it's just really difficult being away from him, but still trying to reach out to him.
Ray, thank you very much. Bruce Hamm, I'm going to ask you this first.
Yeah, I think that's a difficult question because everyone grieves in their own way. But certainly I think helping him to find assistance. And for me, one of the callers said that counseling did not help her, and a lot of people are adverse to that. But I visited three different counselors before I found one that really connected and worked for me. So I do believe that working hard to get someone in some sort of counseling or group can be really, really helpful in their progression forward.
What would you say to Ray? Don?
Yeah, so as often the case, Bruce said it better than I can. I think that you have to have a certain amount of respect for the individual variability in this, and it's very difficult to force people to go into counseling if they're not ready to do that. But I think that being present and trying to remind folks that there is help out there and that in time things will get easier is an important lesson to remind them of.
And I think that's something that we hope comes out of this book, is that these men's story is, it's tragic in its genesis clearly, but it's also a hopeful story with a very hopeful trajectory, and I think Bruce and other men could attest to that.
Ray, thank you so much. Let's get Laura in here from Portland, Maine. Hi, Laura. I don't have much time, but I want to get you in.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I wanted to call in because I'm the adult daughter that these men are raising. My mother died when I was 7 of malignant melanoma, and that was 36 years ago. I'd say it's still a big wound in my soul, but the grief doesn't go away. It gets easier, less intense. And I'm just so proud of all of these men for just getting up every day for their kids and just continuing on. It's something my father, watching him go through, never really figured out. He says a part of him died then, and he's kind of like a zombie now. He's still alive, but he's not. He didn't recover. And I am functional. I'm happy, even though I always have this wound. And my mother also prepared me for this. She took me to funerals of strangers and did a lot of hospice work with me. I got to be at the death and see it happen, which was very helpful to me, too. And the thing I heard once that what makes someone resilient is having just one adult in their childhood who's strong and there for them. And I think that is one of the most important things for me, and that I see that these men are doing with these children they're raising.
Indeed. Laura, thank you so much. Bruce Hamm, you understand Laura's story. Your daughters have come through this very well. In fact, 8 years after your wife's death, you've started a new chapter in your life. Can you tell us about it?
I have, and I think that that's one thing that I could not see when my wife died was hope and an ability to see past tomorrow. But I am engaged now. I've spent a lot of time going out on dates, and finally, about 2.5 years ago, I met someone, and just very, very happy again. So there's great hope, and I could not see that. I could never imagine that I would be able to love someone else deeply again, and I do. And my girls are thriving and doing very, very well, and it's taken a long, long time to get there, but there's a lot of hope.
Laura, thanks for the call. Let's get Dennis in here quickly from Zephyr Hills, Florida. Dennis?
Hi.
Hi.
My question is a little different. In my case, I'm the one who's dying, and I want to know if there's anything I can do now to make it easier on my children and my wife later.
Yeah, what a brave question. Thank you. What you can do is you can talk to them and you can be straight with them. And sometimes the kindest thing that you can do is to have the most difficult conversations. It's tragic when people can anticipate their own death but don't have a chance to say goodbye and pass on important lessons.
Dennis, thank you so much for your call. Well, Justin and Don, you write that you did not anticipate how moved you were by these men and the stories that they shared and the building that happened, the bonds that were built between them. What did you learn quickly from each of these men?
I learned what I think I already knew, and that's resiliency. And I knew some of this from reading about it, but the chance to see that over a 4-year span with these 7 men, that you can be resilient, and that even, as Bruce said, even when you can't see any hope for the future, with time and with connectedness with others and with a little bit of effort, that can happen, and it usually does happen, and that's a good thing.
Done.
And I learned the incredible power of connectedness that these men, there's a magic that can happen when people get together and genuinely share important things.
What an incredible hour. Thank you all for being with me. The book is called The Group, 7 Widowed Fathers Reimagine Life. The authors are Dr. Justin Yap and Dr. Don Rosenstein. Thank you both for being with me today. Really appreciate
it.
And Bruce Hamm there in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, thanks for your bravery and for coming on and sharing your story. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm so grateful to our listeners who called. Thank you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.